You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good morning. I'm Jay Silveria of the Texas A&M Bush School of Washington, D.C. And we're excited this morning to co-sponsor this event with the Brookings Institution. The Bush School of Texas A&M University is new to Washington, but at the same time, the Bush School has a long-standing tradition of sending graduates to work in Washington and abroad in line with an ethos that public service is a noble calling. Our students and faculty look forward to being part of so many impactful discussions in Washington, advancing thought in a number of areas in a nonpartisan way, including today's topic of Russia and China. We have some outstanding faculty that you'll meet today with a wealth of knowledge on the growing global powers. I want to thank Ryan for moderating today's discussion, and thank you to Brookings for being such a valuable partner and today and so many other events with us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jay. We really value our collaboration with the Bush School, and we're grateful to have the opportunity today to explore this conversation about how the United States should approach its relationships with China and Russia. Today's panel is going to have three outstanding experts. I'm going to be inconsiderately brief in introducing them so that we can launch right into the discussion. In alphabetical order, the first is Michael O'Hanlon. Dr. Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow, director of research in the foreign policy program at the Brookings Institution, where he specializes in U.S. defense strategy, the use of military force, and American grand strategy. He is the author most recently of The Art of War in the Age of Peace, a tremendous book which I encourage everyone to go out and buy after they're finished watching this event. The second participant is Dr. Zhongyuan Zoe Liu, who is an associate assistant professor at Texas A&M's Bush School of Government and Public Service in Washington, D.C. She received her doctorate from Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Her areas of expertise include international political economy, comparative politics, and international finance, with a focus on East Asia and China. Our third distinguished presenter is Dr. Yuval Weber, who is an assistant professor at Texas A&M's Bush School of Government and Public Service in Washington, D.C. Dr. Weber also serves as the Brin Chair of Russian Military and Political Strategy at Marine Corps University in Quantico, Virginia. He has expertise on Russian and Eurasian security, political, and economic topics, including Russia's political economy. For our run of show today, we're going to break our conversation into four pieces. The first segment will look at situating the current moment that we find ourselves in the U.S.-China-Russia dynamic, particularly following President Biden's meeting with President Putin in Geneva recently. Then we will examine the challenges that China and Russia pose to the United States, and both of them together to the United States. Then I'm going to ask our panelists for their recommendations of policy advice for dealing with these challenges. And we'll reserve the latter part of our discussion for interaction with our audience. And to anyone in the audience who would like to pose a question or comment, please do so. You can do so via Twitter at #ChinaRussia or via email at events@brookings.edu. So with that housekeeping out of the way, let's jump right into the discussion. Yuval, I'd love to start with you. What do you see as the key takeaways from the recent summit between Biden and Putin? How has Russia and media portrayed the meeting? And what impact, if any, do you see on this meeting for the overall trajectory of U.S.-Russia relations?
Great. Thank you. Those are a lot of great questions. And once again, on behalf of Texas A&M, also very happy to be here and work with Brookings. I think when we think about the Biden-Putin summit, that this was not a reset in any sense of the term, but at least hopefully, you know, fingers crossed that it's a pause in the decline. And what they set out in terms of the next 6 to 12 months is just a test of low-level cooperation that can go basically for the rest of Biden's term in office. In sort of increasing order of complexity, they want to return ambassadors to each other's capitals, reopen diplomatic facilities, because most of them in both countries have been closed in recent years, exchange prisoners, and open up talks on nuclear weapons, what they call strategic stability. And one of the key aspects of that is And one of the reasons that both the United States and Russia have taken turns exiting nuclear weapons agreements over the last number of years is that those come from basically the Cold War. And between the US and USSR, China was not a relevant player in international politics. And so part of thinking about what does strategic stability mean is how to get China into the nuclear weapons conversation, which China has steadfastly opposed. So that's, in essence, the talking about nuclear weapons that they're going to do over the next year. What is also different about Biden, Putin, and Biden is the fifth U.S. president that Putin has dealt with, is that Biden is also the first U.S. president since the end of the Cold War who doesn't need Russia to accomplish his diplomatic aims. Clinton with NATO enlargement, Bush with fighting Islamic terrorism, Obama with nonproliferation, and Trump with getting out of the Middle East, the things that Biden wants to do, restore the U.S. into climate change conversations, the nuclear weapons deal with Iran, those are all things that Russia already wants. So Biden doesn't need Putin in the way that his predecessors did. And that's actually changed a lot of the contours of their relationship. And to that extent, Putin turned up the cyber pressure in recent months just to remind Biden and the U.S. that he still has a few tools in his arsenal. And so what we have in terms of the actual, you know, summit is that Biden sequenced the visits really well. In terms of meeting first G7, then EU, then NATO, he was able to portray himself as the leader of a really large alliance network. The killer and soulless comments the last couple of months were then counterbalanced by the personal charm offensive when he met with Putin. And Putin, in his personal press conference afterwards, was a little bit off kilter at all of these questions and all of these things. What Putin can get out of it is even he can claim that even after 7 years of a pressure campaign, he's still a world leader worthy of special summits, even as he removes Russia from even the pretense of working within the Western system. Unlike the years past when he tried to alleviate domestic repression ahead of interactions with Western leaders, the destruction of Alexei Navalny and the the opposition movement, as well as supporting Belarusian leader Lukashenko's air piracy, shows that he's not going to even bother trying to be friendly, that he just wants to be respected as a person who can shape international politics. The Russian media, because there was no joint press conference and because, you know, in essence, the circus has left town, they've essentially largely moved on in terms of their coverage. There was no big event to cover, or there was no big news to cover, no clear Russian victory, and they have a lot more local and regional news. There's a third COVID wave, elections in Armenia, the national team is still in the Euro 2020 championships. So that's where they are, much less than in years past.
Well, thank you, Yuval. It's a really good insight. I hadn't been following Russia's prowess in the Euro 2021, so it's good to know that they're still fighting away. Zoe, may I turn to you? We often hear about Chinese officials, senior officials, talking about time and momentum being on China's side and the East rising and the West declining. What factors or data do you think the Chinese leadership is using to reach these conclusions? And do you think that anything has happened in the past 6 months since President Biden was inaugurated that could cause them to reevaluate some of those assumptions?
Thank you very much, Ryan. And again, on behalf of Bush School and Texas A&M, I really wanted to say thank you to the Brookings Institution. So go back to your question. Yes, indeed, I think senior Chinese officials, you know, including President Xi and other Politburo members such as Wang Yang, have said earlier this year that the time and momentum or situation are on China's side. But I think, you know, I wanted to remind us that Chinese leaders were neither the first nor the only people that have made such assessment. You know, for example, last October, Ray Dalio, the founder of Bridgewater, said, and I quote here, you know, time is on China's side and is not on the US side, to quote him. So I guess, you know, certainly this kind of, I would say, external validation has boosted the confidence of Chinese leaders. And President Xi made similar comments basically several months later in January this year. So this kind of external validation is not ungrounded. And I would say it's actually supported by China's solid economic performance, even in difficult times. Despite the pandemic last year, China has maintained its position as the world's largest trading nation in goods for at least the past 5 years. And China has also surpassed the U.S. as the largest recipient of FDI last year. And China also experienced a rapid recovery from the pandemic, which led to some optimistic estimates about China's economic outlook. For example, December last year, Center for Economic and Business Research estimated that China would overtake the U.S. to become the world's biggest economy 2028. There are also some other major geopolitical achievement on multilateral front by the end of 2020 that may have also boosted Chinese leaders' confidence. One such example is the RCEP, and then the other is the China-EU Comprehensive Agreement on Investment. So this kind of development set the stage for China to play a bigger role as the rule maker or even agenda setter in the post-pandemic global system. And apart from these external validations, I would say they are also important internal validations, if you will, following China's better economic performance. First, since the global financial crisis, then the recent COVID experience. China's rapid economic rebound during the global financial crisis has led to what we have been seeing today. China has been seeking greater influence in global governance. And then China's, I would say, emphasize perceived effective pandemic management and rapid economic comeback post-pandemic have further strengthened Chinese people's confidence in the CCP's leadership, as well as the Chinese model of crisis management and probably economic development as well. And this would in turn strengthen the CCP's confidence in its leadership at home. So this the kind of effectiveness of the CCP's leadership perhaps looms even larger when compared with the rest of the world, especially when we are looking at the disappointing pandemic management here in the United States and combined with the chaotic election cycle last year, as well as other major domestic movements. So apart from these internal and external validations, I would also emphasize that there might be some unwelcoming international factors that China faced today may have pushed Chinese leaders to step up and emphasize self-reliance. On one hand, we see deteriorating relationship with the United States as well as other Western powers. This suggests that China today is definitely facing a far less welcoming global environment compared with, say, 2001 when China was first admitted to the WTO. And then on the other hand, there is this three-year or so U.S.-China trade war and the stringent U.S. technology sanctions against China. We do see this deteriorating relationship, but so far, U.S. sanctions have not yielded the desired outcome from U.S. perspective. Instead, this, to a very large extent, has accelerated the process for China and Chinese companies to seek dominance or even monopoly over critical elements, especially strategic minerals such as, you know, cobalt for electric vehicles, batteries, and as well as rare earths for almost all kinds of high-tech industries. So I guess to sum up, you know, internal and external validations boosted the leaders' confidence, and then there is also unwelcoming international environment pushed the leaders to be more to step up. So if there are any recent development that may have caused leaders in Beijing to reevaluate this kind of assumptions, I guess I would highlight two. One is, you know, President Biden, he has sent a strong signal to the world that America is back since he took office. And countering to a lot of emphasis, a lot of estimates in Beijing, you know, Biden administration has not reset U.S.-China relationship yet. And then the other factor would be the suspension of EU-China investment agreement.
Thank you, Zoe. Michael, I'd love to turn to you next. You're welcome to pick up any of the threads that Yuval or Zoe put on the table. But I did want to ask you something about your most recent book, The Art of War in the Age of Peace. In it, you suggest that, quote, trends in technology combined with Russian and Chinese strategic advantages require a fuller reconceptualization of American grand strategy. And you also talk about and put forward an idea of resolute restraint as an organizing principle of our grant strategy. I was just wondering if you could help us unpack those two ideas.
Thanks, Ryan, and greetings, everyone, and Yuval and Zoe and friends at Texas A&M. Thank you. I remember back to when, as a young scholar at Brookings, I joined a delegation to the Bush School in the year 2000, Richard Haass led from Brookings, and we had the privilege of meeting with President Bush and also General Scowcroft. It was right between the election and the determination that Bush had defeated Gore. And so it was a fascinating moment. And also, when I think back to those two gentlemen, and especially President Bush, I think about how to manage great power relations in a time of turbulence. And I think that one of the accomplishments of the Bush-Baker-Scowcroft period is that, of course, they managed to make Russia, or the decaying Soviet Union that then became Russia by 1991 again, make Gorbachev and others feel that their security interests were being recognized even as Germany was reunified. So we did something very much in the American interest with the reunification of Germany, but we spent a lot of time making Gorbachev and other Russians feel that we were not looking to put NATO into their face in an aggressive way. We agreed not to put combat forces on former East German territory, for example. And the spirit with which that was done, I fear, was lost a little bit in the subsequent American administrations that, to my mind, expanded NATO a little bit excessively, or certainly a little bit too quickly, and in a way that was likely to produce the kind of Russian reaction that Putin now embodies. So one of the elements of my restraint agenda is not to expand NATO any further into the former Soviet space. And I think the idea of bringing Ukraine or Georgia into NATO is a very bad idea, not suggesting that we unilaterally abandon that idea without demanding some help from Russia in ensuring the security of Ukraine and Georgia through other means. And I also want to do this in consultation with the rest of NATO, obviously, but also with Ukraine and Georgia. But that's a big part of the concept of restraint. That, and the resoluteness part, Ryan, is that we have to still defend NATO. And the existing 30 members must be treated as all equally important. Whether myself or anybody else had some qualms about expanding as far as we have now into the former Soviet space, it was not an aggressive action. It may have been interpreted that way, but it was not. We should not apologize for it. And we should certainly not let our deterrence or defense of the Baltic states, Poland, or any other new member slip or recede into a second tier status. So as you see, that's where I'm, that's a good example of how I would invoke the concept of resolute restraint. In regard to China, I agree with what Zoe has said, but I also think there's a more critical interpretation of China's behavior. And by the way, let me plug the book of a young man named Ryan Haass, who has served in government on these issues and recently written about them. And I would encourage anybody watching this show to buy that book and also understand the lessons from that argument. Because in regard to China, first of all, Zoe, I would agree with your points, but I would also add that, you know, China was the source of the virus. You don't have to be a Trump person to say that. You don't have to believe it was deliberate on China's part. But the notion that China should be demanding bragging rights over COVID-19, to me, is actually not only incorrect, but slightly offensive. You know, the number of people around the world who have died, the number of economies that have suffered because of a virus that originated in a way that China could have prevented if it had done some of the things it was supposed to do in regard to its wet markets and other kinds of activity. So I say this not to get into a big fight with the Chinese, but to remind people that as we do a net assessment on China's rise, which is quite impressive in so many ways, and to my mind, quite welcome in so many ways, we need to bear in mind some of the problems and downsides as well. I don't think China's going to be able to just go around the world and ride some wave of popularity just because it is seen as the rising power. By the way, nor do I think that the United States is a declining power. I think the United States has everything within its capacity to be still the most impressive country on earth in the 21st century. And again, I will underscore that is the chief argument or goal, at least, of your book, because the word stronger is about us, about how we need to aspire to reinvigorate the domestic and foreign policy foundations of our success. Because whether China reaches our GDP or not in the next few years, this is still a much better place to live. It's a much better place to do business. It's a much better place to speak your mind. And we lead a coalition and an alliance system that's unmatched in the history of the world that China can only begin to dream about on its happiest moments. And so all I'm trying to say is I want to support your agenda of positivity, that even though we're stressed, even though we have challenges, that we should not be somehow thinking that the, you know, wave of history is passing us by. One last word in regard to resolute restraint, and then I hope perhaps you'll offer a comment in addition to playing this kind role as moderator. But in regard to restraint with China, let me actually just give two examples. One, I would not have called the Chinese oppression of the Uyghurs in Xinjiang province genocide. I don't think it is genocide by any fair definition of that term. I know you can find a lawyer to make the argument that it is, I don't mean you, Ryan, I mean the State Department or the Biden administration or the Trump administration, both of which, to my mind, have made a mistake in using that term, because we know historically and in our gut what the word genocide means, where it came from, with the Ottoman treatment of the Armenians, but then especially Hitler's treatment of the Jews. And this is where the term began to have a popular use in history, in international relations. What the Chinese are doing in Xinjiang province is nothing of the sort. I think we need to be able to be critical of China in a businesslike and fair and proportionate way, but not rev ourselves up into such a state of hysteria over this that we wind up going down a path towards inevitable confrontation, which I don't think should be inevitable. So that's one very specific example that the Biden team and the Trump team sort of teed up for me. But I think these kind of symbolic issues are important. And so I don't consider it just a throwaway line. It's a pretty crucial issue. In regard to military planning, I do believe that we should stay engaged in the Western Pacific. I do believe we should insist on free navigation through the South China Sea, et cetera. And I think that if China ever attacked Taiwan, China needs to know there's no going back to a normal relationship with the United States. Whether we intervene militarily or not is a question for the moment based on how the crisis developed. But we would have to change the relationship fundamentally, including in economic realms, if China ever were to attack Taiwan. But I might use some restraint in the event that, let's say, the Chinese blockaded Taiwan. Rather than trying to bust our way through the blockade, sinking Chinese ships and submarines in the process, which would have been the historical default assumption of how we would break a blockade, I think that would be potentially escalatory. And our first response should actually be a combination of economic warfare combined with putting pressure on China's ability to use the sea lanes of the Indian Ocean, through which it gets a lot of its energy and other raw materials, and then see if we could use a diplomatic process to walk back the crisis. So that's an element where I would want to be resolute, punishing China severely, but also restrained in not escalating immediately to a direct all-out confrontation with combat forces 100 miles from China's shores, 8,000 miles from our own. Thank you, Ryan.
Well, the three of you have put a lot on the table, and you're already eliciting a lot of questions and comments from our viewers, which I encourage and ask everyone to continue to submit. To just briefly take up your invitation, Michael, to offer a comment, I would just simply agree that the United States, I believe, is the best positioned country in the world to face the challenges of the 21st century. And the areas that are our sources of strength are domestic dynamism, our alliance network, our global prestige, are issues that we alone control. And the more that we can invest in sort of accentuating those strengths, I think the stronger position we'll be in to regain a bit of confidence, which will allow us to have a little bit more calm and cool-headedness and steadiness in how we approach some of these challenges. But with that, and I know that Zoe will pick up a few of the themes that you raised when we turn to her. But I first want to give you all a chance to jump in. I have a very simple question. Where is it specifically that Russian behavior most directly challenges America?
Russia challenges the United States in lots of places. And I think part of that is also from what Mike said a moment ago about NATO enlargement. Whatever the interpretations that we have, Putin's, one of his chief domestic successes has been to create the grievance that, you know, the end of the Cold War, as we discussed, between George H.W. Bush and Mikhail Gorbachev coming together, peacefully ending this, and keeping the Soviet Union in a position of relative equality with the U.S. Certainly not as strong. That's obviously the end of the Cold War. But the idea that there would be a neutral buffer zone between NATO and the Soviet Union, and that basically disappearing after the Soviet Union disappeared and all these countries taking their moment while Russia was weak to go to the other side. That's in effect what Putin has been developing and nursing for the past 20 odd years as his position in power. And his entire system of governance is based on Russia not ever collapsing to that extent again. So he's willing to make Russia a less dynamic, less open place in order to never have that happen under him or the next person. So that's key to understanding the Russian interpretation of regime resilience and autonomy against the US. So in all the different things in which Russia tries to challenge the US, it's to basically articulate a larger claim that the unipolar moment of the United States is over, that its leadership of the Euro-Atlantic Alliance may be good for itself, but it's not the only thing available in this world. So when we think about, you know, all the cyber attacks back and forth and going after gas pipelines or meat processing plants, all these different things, it's to ensure that Russia isn't ignored and that Russia's interests are not, you know, just totally thrown out the window. So particularly when it comes to cyber, that's something in which you don't have to put a million people under arms. You don't have to have an entire new generation of nuclear weapons. It's a relatively cheaper way of making sure that the contours of international politics are basically a two-way street. Between that, between the challenges to democracy, between the challenges to global governance, those are the things in which Russia wants to articulate that unipolarity is over. And when it comes to issues such as restraint, which Mike was talking about a moment ago, where basically the Russian commentariat is trying to figure out is this restraint because the U.S. is acknowledging what it can't do any further in terms of after Iraq, after global financial crisis in 2008, after Afghanistan, that these are the limits of U.S. power. And that's part of the conversation that obviously Washington has. Or is this basically just a cooling off period in which, you know, the U.S. is going to consolidate its gains over the unipolar period? So they look at restraint as either this is something that we have to fight as well, or basically, you know, they're just going to come back for more. And when the U.S. basically gets its act back together, it's going to be in this anti-China context. And if it's in the anti-China context, that's essentially where, you know, Russia can be most useful. Either because they can't go it alone in international affairs, they don't have the capabilities for that. But basically to be pro-China, and you know, that's maybe where the conversation can go, or to put itself forth as what is a side deal that Russia can do with the US. So all of the different areas of confrontation, Syria, Sub-Saharan Africa, Eastern Europe, you know, cyber, everything, it's all basically waiting. What is the next era of international affairs? And what's the strongest available position on not just any specific issue, but writ large, that Putin can make a deal either with Biden or, you know, he's the fifth U.S. president, maybe the sixth or maybe the seventh might be a little bit more friendly. Putin just changed the constitution to be in power till 2036. So he's there, you know, for the long term. And that's more important than any specific area of confrontation.
Thank you. It's very interesting. Zoe, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to the ideas that Michael put on the table, but I also would like to tack on a question for you, because I know you've been thinking a lot about de-dollarization and some of the financial connectivity between Moscow and Beijing. And so my question is, as Moscow and Beijing move closer together on a variety of fronts, including in finance and energy, how do you see these trends impacting American interests as well as America's ability to exercise influence over both China and Russia?
Yeah, thank you very much, Ryan, for the question. And I will come back to Mike's question later, but I would, you know, want to share my thoughts on the de-dollarization issue first in particular. And I think, Ryan, you are right that China and Russia have indeed moved closer together despite the two countries share or have complicated bilateral relationship throughout the history of the PRC. And I would say right now, we are probably at the worst times for US-China relations since 1972. And a lot of the commentators are saying, also saying that we are at the best of times for China-Russia relationship. So I would say in recent years, especially since 2014, Western sanctions led by the United States indeed have pushed Russia to isolate its economy and financial relations from the dollar-based global financial system and attempt to de-dollarize its trade and reduce holdings of dollar reserves, such as the U.S. Treasury from its foreign exchange reserves. And I would highlight two events. One is Russia's central banks establish its own independent national payment system that can be considered as Russia's alternative to Visa and MasterCard. And then the other would be Russia's own proprietary financial messaging system called System for Transfer of Financial Messages. And this would be Russia's an analog to the SWIFT system, basically. So, following recent Biden administration's new sanction imposure on Russia, Russia further increased its de-dollarization efforts and decided to completely remove dollar assets from its sovereign wealth fund or the national wealth fund, and decided to diversify or swap dollar asset to 30% to RMB and 40% to euro. So here we do see that Russia has actually been actively seeking China as its de-dollarization partner. And I think this is understandable because in order for Russia to achieve wider acceptance for its national card system, as well as international coverage for its cross-border payment infrastructure, Russia would necessarily rely upon China in the sense that China launched its own cross-border interbank payment system in 2015, but that is not necessarily to counter the dollar hegemon, but rather to support it in the internationalization. And starting from 2016 all the way to the recent Russia meeting with China, there is this consistent calling for China to join Russia's effort to de-dollarize. But from my research, as far as I know, I haven't seen any public record quoting any senior Chinese officials saying that China is in this business for de-dollarization or dethroning the dollar. And throughout the Chinese leaders' language has been actually quite very well calibrated. They put this in the context of diversify the global financial system, diversify the currency system, rather than distorting the dollar. But we do see this emergence of Russia-China collaboration in the sense that they are providing seemingly an alternative or parallel global financial system that is not necessarily centered around the dollar. So from my perspective, this is probably a challenge to U.S. Sanction power, and rather than direct challenge, I would say it's not necessarily. It's more about Russia being pushed to pursue this route. So there is this potential that China and Russia might mobilize other countries across multiple platforms, such as BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, to create a bigger financial system that are not dollar centric. But I would say, in any international transactions, you have people who want to pay in non-dollar, but then you also need your counterpart to be willing to accept the dollar. So as long as the dollar being, as long as international investors and international business people have a confidence in the dollar, and as long as the SWIFT is the primary payment system, I don't necessarily see how this emerging China-Russia de-dollarization coalition may necessarily have credible challenge to the U.S. Financial leadership. Going back to Mike's point, I would say yes, I agree with a lot of the point that Michael raised, especially in terms of China's international image during the pandemic. I think it has posed a very challenging situation for Chinese government in terms of crisis response and things like that. But a lot of this recent development, I would say, on the one hand, reflect China's genuine frustration with the international system. And on the other hand, I would say there is also a genuine sense of being caught off guard. Probably, I would say, scholars of China studies all know China has been described as this fragmented authoritarianism, or the entire Chinese system has been described as fragmented. So what happens at the local level may not necessarily be, firsthand aware by the central Chinese government leaders.
Thank you. So, Zoe, just to make sure that our listeners understand what you're saying, I'm going to try to summarize in one sentence the threat of de-dollarization, and tell me if we've got it right. That Russia is the primary enthusiast of de-dollarization of cross-border flows. China is a bit more reticent, in part given their exposure to dollar holdings. And there doesn't appear to be a lot of enthusiasm by countries around the world for joining the de-dollarization bandwagon. Is that a fair summary?
I think, Ryan, you are right. I wanted to say, this is probably, another corroborating material for your book or your conceptualization of a competitive interdependence, in the sense that Russia has been pushed to pursue this route of de-dollarization, whereas China has been very carefully collaborating its language, recognizing that, yes, there is the need for renminbi internationalization, but then China really wanted to do it on China's term and not necessarily being pushed. And if you look at, the recent debate over the central bank digital currency launched by the PBOC, when being questioned or being asked if this is, intentionally challenging the dollar hegemon, and you see Chinese policymakers come out and clarify, no, this is not necessarily challenging the dollar. It's, part of the renminbi internationalization strategy. You are right.
Thank you. Michael, I want to turn it to you next. I have two questions, and I welcome you to pick up anything else along the way as well. The first question, in reading your book, your most recent book, you don't seem particularly anxious about the prospect of Europe pursuing greater strategic autonomy, distancing itself a little bit from the United States. You also don't exhibit a lot of concern or anxiety about China and Russia pulling more closely together to the disadvantage of the United States. Is that an accurate reading of your arguments?
Yes, especially on the first. So let me just say a couple of words, but I'm also going to go back a little bit to Yuval's point about the unipolar moment. And I just want to add one perspective to what he said without disagreeing in any way with his points, but maybe as the old man in this conversation today, although all of us, I'm sure, have some memories of the 1990s, but the unipolar moment didn't feel that powerful if you were an American sitting in Washington. Remember Somalia, when we lost 18 servicemen in a tragic raid, and we pulled out of Somalia, one of the least militarily capable countries on earth, rather than go in and impose our will. And in the Balkans Wars, which I studied carefully and wrote a book about in regard to Kosovo with Ivo Dalder, we were insistent on not accepting any casualties, and therefore that limited our operational space, and we had a very hard time winning that war. And then when Osama bin Laden declared war against the United States in 1996 and carried out the embassy bombings in Africa in 1998, our only response was to use cruise missiles, primarily against a training site that he had abandoned before we even could have the missiles arrive on target, which again went to show perhaps self-imposed domestic political constraints on our power more than absolute or structural constraints. But nonetheless, the 1990s didn't feel like such halcyon days if you really go back and remember year by year what was going on. And by the way, let me say one nice thing about Putin, which I'll rarely do. But in this case, what I will say about Putin is, as much as he is a challenge for us to deal with, I prefer the Russia of today to the Russia of the 1990s. And I know Russians do, too, because in the 1990s, what we had to fear was Russian state collapse and loose Russian nuclear materials or even weapons, or a brain drain of Russian nuclear scientists going to extremist states where their services might be purchased because their own government couldn't pay them any longer. Russian weakness was not in our interest either. And in the 1990s, we spent a lot of time worried about that. So I would simply say to, you know, this is not really, this is an indirect point in terms of our conversation today, but the complicated, multifaceted, increasingly multipolar world we live in today, it's not so bad compared to some of the alternatives that I've seen. And, you know, we also had a moment of American unipolarity in the late 1940s. That was because our allies had been decimated by World War II. It wasn't anything so great. And so, again, I don't mind the challenges of today, which is part of why I have the view that this is still an age of peace, as the title of my book would suggest. In regard to Europe and strategic autonomy, there's two main aspects to this. One is military, one is economic. On the economic side, Zoe and you, Ryan, and others, I think, know more than I do. But I would simply say on the military side, when Europe tries to become somewhat more autonomous, these are typically very incremental steps towards greater autonomy, because European friends know they can't really defend the Baltic states and the other eastern frontiers of Europe on their own. They need our help in dealing with Russia for political, military, strategic, economic reasons. We're only going to be able to take on Russia together. And if you start giving Russia the chance to pick apart one piece of the Baltics at a time, because there's no longer a strong NATO, because somehow the EU military force has replaced that, and now an EU force doesn't even include the Brits, that EU force is going to have a hard time facing down Putin, given how far we've expanded both the European Union and NATO into the former Soviet space and former Warsaw Pact space. So I don't really think the Europeans will ever decide to devalue NATO, unless, you know, we're just as likely to overdo it by seeking or winding up in confrontation against Russia that we didn't need to have. That may be the greater risk. If the United States does that, the Europeans may pull away. But I think they know full well they don't really want to face the Russian bear on their own, and nor do they really want to face China on their own. Now, here we may get pushback. And again, I'll defer to others who know the economic relationships better than I do. But just as with a country that you're very familiar with, Ryan, South Korea or Australia, I think we can learn from our European friends by actually not always expecting them to quickly fall into lockstep with us on any anti-Chinese policy, but actually having a fulsome dialogue about which policy makes the most sense. And I actually welcome the fact that Europeans may not always be quite as hawkish against China as we can be. So that would be the main point. On Russia and China, you know, we've heard some good discussion from the panel already, and Zoe's underscored some of the limits on economic cooperation. But I do worry that if we have unnecessarily hostile policies towards either or both, that we will tend to push them more and more together. There's only so much and so far that Russia can go in replacing the Western consumer market for China. I mean, China needs a billion wealthy Westerners to buy its stuff, and 135 not so wealthy Russians cannot be a replacement for that. So there is a natural structural limitation on how far this collaboration can go in some ways. But yes, I worry about it. And that's one of the reasons why I don't want to have fights with China and Russia that we don't need to have. I want to see if we can manage the relationships more than escalate them both into confrontation. Thank you.
Well, that's a perfect segue, Michael, into where I'd like to take our conversation next, which is I want to situate the three of you in the Situation Room. There's a debate going on about how to deal with China and Russia and this strategic triangle. This is not, you know, too dissimilar from the discussions that are taking place inside of our government now about how to deal with this. And there are a variety of schools of thought. Some people believe that we should try to prioritize relations with one to try to pull one closer than the other to reestablish ourselves at the base of this strategic triangle. There are some who want to accentuate differences between China and Russia to try to create wedges. Others advocate for viewing this as a contest between democracies and autocracies and how we need to sort of mobilize the world to counter the threat that they pose. There may be other ideas on offer that I'm overlooking here, but how would you recommend our policy adapt going forward to deal with the dynamics that we've been discussing for the past 45 minutes? So if I could start with you, and then we'll turn to Michael and we'll give Yuval the final word on this second.
Yeah, thank you very much, Ryan. And I think from a pure conversational perspective, it might be attempting to view this kind of relationships through the prisms of a contest between political regimes and ideology. But from my perspective, I don't think this would work in practice. You know, indeed, President Biden recently said that democracies need to counter autocracies. But at the same time, he also repeatedly emphasized that his goal was not to conflict with adversaries, but instead to find points of compromise. So I think right now, since President Biden came into power, it gives the world the impression that America's geopolitical focus is not necessarily at the Atlantic Ocean, but rather the Indo-Pacific. But, you know, in many ways, I think the reality is that from China's perspective, or both U.S.-China relationship, the two countries are becoming more interdependent in a more complex way, or just to quote your book, Competitive Interdependence. And by this, you know, I wanted to put my own spin on it in the sense that, you know, China is no longer a content junior partner in this relationship with the United States. And the United States is probably no longer overly accommodating counterpart either. So, you know, this means, you know, for in many ways, if U.S. try to contain China, it would inevitably invite negative response from the Chinese side. But I guess I tend to be an optimistic. I wanted to highlight some of the bright side. You know, despite all these rising geopolitical tensions between U.S. and China, we do see the two countries are still moving closer together, or, you know, competitive interdependence, a major risk of viewing this contested relationship through ideology or regime is that it would miss out all these practical ties, such as finance, economic, and people-to-people relationship. So, for example, you know, U.S. financial institutions recently have actually been moving closer to China and the Chinese capital more than ever before. We've seen U.S. financial giants, Goldman Sachs, BlackRock, JP Morgan, you name it. They have announced that they've established partnership with leading Chinese banks. So from investors' perspective, if I were an investor, I would think probably this is another era of gold rush into China. And I would think the biggest risk for me now is not getting into China quickly enough. So, but this does not necessarily say there is no geopolitical tensions or China and the United States are sharing more and more common interest. If anything, I would reemphasize my advisor, Professor David Lampton, his famous book, you know, Same Bad, Different Dreams. This has been proven to be correct, and I think it's going to be correct in the long run as well. So people have used this same bad, different dreams to describe China and Russia, but I would say probably China has more in similar with the United States than it has with Russia. Just, you know, in the same way that Michael has emphasized. So I would just emphasize that, you know, probably based upon this difference similarity assessment, probably wedge strategy and accentuating differences between Beijing and Moscow would probably be a better option than approaching China and Russia as an ideological bloc, because they are not. And I do not necessarily think any Chinese people or Chinese academics or Chinese leader would portray China as a communist.
Thank you. Michael?
Very quickly, Ryan, I like Zoe's answer, and I would like to hear yours too. And I don't have, so I'm going to defer to the senator from the cherry blossom state behind you. But I will say that I think the best thing we can do is not worry too much about finding exactly the right paradigm, but trying to keep both relationships in pretty good shape to the extent possible, not looking for unnecessary provocations or fights. And I think that will solidify the fact that both countries will perceive us to be at least a sometimes partner rather than an adversary. That's the single best thing we can do rather than get too clever about our strategy. Over.
Yuval?
Sure. So a moment ago, a representative from Brookings Institute described that the Russia of today is preferable to the Russia of the 1990s because Putin has consolidated authoritarianism, but it's a much more stable state. And the state capacity of Russia is just so much more. And so for a moment, I thought I was having a stroke to hear that. But what we can sort of take from that is that the Russia of the 1990s no longer exists. And to try to shape international politics to get to that is not going to be the best use of American energy, time, or money. So in that, like, the Russians also understand there's no like serious analyst within Russia, within Moscow, who doesn't understand the Russia-China relationship is fairly unequal in favor of China. But as I said before, what are Poon's options? Going it alone, the capabilities just aren't there. China and the U.S. can just swamp Russia at any given moment. Capitulating to the U.S. in terms of joining some sort of anti-China coalition, Putin would be out of office that afternoon. So that's not good. So the least bad of all three options is working with China in order to balance the United States to the maximum extent, but not to give too much in order to allow the U.S. to make a better offer at some point in the future. And that, in effect, is Putin's long game. Where is basically like the way to get at and to impose costs on Russia? I would suggest it has to do with transnational kleptocracy and repression. The key thing, and President Xi is the same, but a little bit different because China is a much more open country, at least economically, is that one of the key things that Putin can deliver is a highly unequal society to the people who actually matter. So the military services, security services, super rich people within Russia, those are the people benefiting from the status quo. And one of the key things that Putin can do is make sure there's total capital mobility and openness to the outside financial world so that these people, in effect, can take their gains outside of Russia to protect themselves against any potential change in power at home in Moscow. And so if the United States, and President Biden's actually been moving more rapidly and aggressively on this than the last couple presidents, to try and stop the ability of money to buy influence and to find the safe harbor in the US and other places in the financial system, that would actually be the way to impose costs on Putin and on Xi at home. And that's where I would suggest the US put its energies.
Fascinating. We have a question from Justin Long, who is at the U.S. military or U.S. Marine Corps War College. He asked, how do we avoid driving China and Russia further together? What steps do we need to not take in order to push these two countries together? Or is that possible? And I'm going to add another question so that you can pick what you want to respond to here. But the other question is from Abigail Kinsington, who asked, does President Putin rely upon animosity from the United States to sustain his domestic standing? So over to the three of you, I'm guessing that Yuval and Michael may want to take a swing at this, but Zoe, you're welcome to jump in as well.
So the reason Russia and China are working together on a number of things is because they both share being the recipient of unremitting hostility from the U.S. foreign policy agenda. That's the core thing of why I don't think that Putin and Xi, you know, find each other particularly handsome individuals, that they enjoy each other's company to some extent. It's the fact that the U.S. is trying to change the way that they govern their countries at home and abroad. That's the key thing, which is putting them together. The Russians understand that with China's Belt and Road Initiative, that they are displacing Russian economic, political and security influence in Central Asia, and that that is moving across as the Belt and Road Initiative gets closer and closer to Europe. Like there are already military bases, technically called military police stations, in Tajikistan and in Kyrgyz Republic, in you know the former, you know, the Russian sphere of influence. So all these things are happening, but giving into the U.S. is worse. And that's basically a core thing right there. And then in terms of the animosity from the United States, that just acknowledges, the United States hates us for basically asserting our independence. They hate us for our sovereignty. They hate us for being ourselves. And therefore, if we were to give in on anything, as the argument goes, that would be basically the end of the stability of Russia today. And so like Putin never talks about we're an authoritarian country. Like, you know, we crush the dissidents in our country. He always says something to the effect of we are in favor of stability and we are opposed to all sources of instability in our country, whether they're domestic, whether they're foreign. And so when in his last press conference, he was tying Alexei Navalny to Black Lives Matter, as well as the January 6th protesters, he's basically saying, you have problems in your country is in a bad position. We are basically doing what we can to make sure that we can live as freely and independently as possible. And so if you don't like us for that, that's more your problem than ours. So I would then defer to the other colleagues.
If I could pick up, I like that answer. I would simply suggest the framing that we should give Russia and China their due, but also criticize strongly when we have issues. And so what I mean by that, to give an example, because both Xi and Putin have been bad, in my judgment, for their own countries within the last half dozen to 10 years. But with Putin, I would actually sort of begrudgingly holding my nose, give him a little bit of credit for what he did in his first stint as president. Because in that period of time, he did arrest the deterioration of the Russian state that had been ongoing under Yeltsin, and that I do not think was in America's national security interest, and certainly not in Russia's. And he stabilized the economy. He stabilized, to some extent, the military. And for a while, he tried to work with us, too, until he got fed up with us. And I don't excuse him for that. But the 2000 to 2008 period was relatively, at least, mixed. But since he's been president again, starting in 2012, he's become, as you say, a domestic tyrant and autocrat. And you know, he's oppressed and maybe even had killed his domestic opposition. And this has been inexcusable. I know a lot of Russians who are very sad about what Putin's done to their country in the second increment of his presidency, which, as you say, now risks going on for another 15 years and leaving a terrible legacy. So I would like to give Putin his due for what he did in the first 8 years, but try to put pressure on him where he's really destroyed Russian democracy in many ways, primarily since 2012. And with the Chinese communists, even though they were never a democracy, and here I try to learn from Ryan and others at Brookings who understand the country better than I do, but I think we should give a little bit of credit to what they've done for the well-being of their own people, and frankly, a lot of their neighbors and others with whom they trade in terms of economic capability, in terms of just human survival. China's rise has been the most impressive single event in economic and human development terms in the history of the planet, in terms of the number of people who have been brought out of poverty and given a better chance to stay alive. And I think we should find a way to acknowledge that while we also criticize over the treatment of the Uyghurs or the treatment of Hong Kong or the threats against Taiwan or the suppression of dissent or the unwillingness to be open about COVID-19. And so I'm not suggesting in any way that we back off on the issues where we disagree. But if we frame this in a context where we can acknowledge the accomplishments as well, I think we just sort of moderate the tone in a more constructive fashion.
Please, sorry.
If I can just quickly jump in here, I just wanted to say, I think I agree with Yuval and Michael. And, I just wanted to say diplomacy is not necessarily about having parties dealing with your friends, but really it's about how to manage different situations in different times and, you know, negotiate with your adversaries. So in this sense, I totally agree with Michael and Yuval. And just to sort of go back to the question quickly, how to avoid driving China and Russia closer. I think, I personally do not necessarily think Russia and China do have a lot of things, in similar, apart from the fact that they both are very frustrated with the United States and the existing status quo of global order. But on top of that, I wanted to emphasize that probably here in the United States, we should probably de-emphasize or not overly exaggerate the China's threat. Not only because China faces its own challenges both at home and abroad, but also, beneath China's expressed this frustration and this dissatisfaction or discontent, China actually has benefited from the global system led by the United States.
We have just 2 minutes left, so I'm going to ask a quick question of the three of you. And if you could just answer in a couple of sentences, that would be wonderful, because I think it's important for us as we're looking at the Sino-Russian relationship to also understand the limits of it. And earlier this year, there was a lot of hand-wringing and concern about the prospect of Russia massing forces near Ukraine, China accelerating its incursions around Taiwan, and whether or not there could be a synchronization of military efforts between China and Russia. How much or how little should we be concerned about that? Why don't we start with Yuval and then Michael and Zoe?
Sure. I think President Biden indirectly answered your question when he talked about whether Ukraine can get into NATO. There was a big kerfuffle a couple days or weeks ago. And he said that, until Ukraine basically solves its domestic corruption issue, that there's not going to be much movement on any of those. So I think when he's saying that, he was saying, as soon as Ukraine can qualify into the European Union, then it's possible to, for Ukraine to get into NATO. And at that point, when he's talking about all of the institutionalization, the Quad and everything else that's happening in Asia Pacific, what I think basically the US policy is, whatever Russia and China do, that's up to them. But can the United States essentially create a bigger zone for NATO and a bigger zone for some sort of Asian NATO-like structure over there in order to basically prepare for whatever Russia and China want to do to each other or with each other?
I'll just say, Ryan, that to the extent that we have proportionate strategies for dealing with small crises that are largely about using economic instruments, maybe limited military redeployments rather than actual use of combat power, to the extent we have that philosophy, not only are we being resolutely restrained, as I advocate in my book, but we're giving ourselves the ability to handle simultaneous crises because we're not somehow using the preponderance of national power over one versus the other. And so again, to minimize the risks of simultaneous crises, I would want to also keep our responses proportionate and therefore also not have Ukraine and NATO, because I don't think that's a good place for us to pick a showdown against Russia.
I guess on my end, I would just emphasize that probably it's important to, for the United States to not underestimate China's commitment to Taiwan, and recognizing that this is a different issue from China's perspective.
Well, this has been a really rich conversation. I wish we had another hour, but our time is up. I think that the three of you have contributed mightily to a discussion that is going to be with us for a long time. Thank you for your contributions, and we look forward to carrying the conversation forward in the future.